It's here and now, and coming up, you might be surprised to hear that teenagers are the most vulnerable age group when it comes to kidnappings. But first, President Bush has invited a select group of Republicans, those skeptical of his plan to increase troop numbers in Iraq, to the White House for a meeting today. This as a bipartisan group of senators forges ahead on a resolution opposing raising troop levels. Congressional correspondent Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor is covering the story. She joins us from Washington. And Gail, first of all, do we know who was invited to today's meeting? And are there any new names, you know, that might indicate the president is losing ground?
I have not seen the total list of people that are going, but, you know, he could almost have picked at random among the Republican caucus to find people with doubts about this plan. There are very few who are standing absolutely solidly with him at that point. I would include among those John McCain and Lindsey Graham. But I've been struck even by those who I'd always assumed would be strong supporters, Jeff Sessions of Alabama, for example, that he's been involved in fairly regular discussions with the White House about his own doubts and concerns. The president has been on a listening campaign with members of Congress unlike anything we've seen in his presidency to date. And at least some of the senators I've talked to feel that he's hearing what they're saying.
Well, some fairly prominent Republicans, including Chuck Hagel, are signing on to the anti-increase resolution. It might be announced today or tomorrow.
Today,
okay. But the White House seems to be dismissing the importance of at least Chuck Hagel's involvement, saying, you know, well, he's been a long time critic, but is that washing with people, these, you know, dismissals?
No. This is a real crisis in the Republican caucus right now, in both the House and the Senate. Senator Reid counts about a dozen Republicans he thinks he can pull with Democrats on a kind of bipartisan resolution. Coming right at the time of the State of the Union address, this will be a real blow to the president, and the president will argue a real blow to the war effort as well, because it will look to the rest of the world as if Congress has turned its back.
But is it just a perception issue? Because it's non-binding, so is it just, it could be very symbolic, but will it have any impact at all on troop increases?
First step, I think it's too late to stop troop increases. The president has already started that process. Members, Democrats in both the House and the Senate have said that they will not pull resources from troops that are already in the field. So it kind of sets up a fait accompli here. I think what we are looking at is buying a few months, but also registering a level of protest that the Congress has not demonstrated to date. I think if this bill passes with strong Republican support, you will very quickly see moves. Senator Kennedy, for example, is proposing legislation with teeth that would prevent the president from moving troops forward and also potentially pull funds. But for something like that to move, it would require overruling a presidential veto, and I'm not clear that they have the two-thirds it would take to do that as yet. What I'm looking at very closely is what John Murtha, who chairs the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, is starting today. Closed hearings on readiness that he plans to link to funding for troops. Now, that'll take a month or so. But I think that is where Congress can really make a dent in this process, once it starts pulling funding. And I think Murtha is right at the head of the line on that.
Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from the halls there. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, more charges are expected today against Michael Devlin, the alleged abductor of two boys in Missouri. He already faces one count of child kidnapping, a charge that carries the penalty of life in prison. The two young boys were found in Devlin's apartment. One, Ben Ownby, had been missing, for 4 days. The other, Sean Hornbeck, for 4 years. In a moment, we're going to speak to a forensic pediatric specialist to ask the question many are asking: why didn't Sean, who had a lot of freedom of movement, try try to escape? And are many other young people also living with their abductors so long after a kidnapping? But first, the latest in the case itself, we turn to Robert Patrick. He's court reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And Robert, two boys, but only one charge against Michael Devlin. Now, we understand that might have something to do with the fact that child kidnapping wasn't on the books in Missouri until, 2004?
That's right. He is charged with child kidnapping in the case of Ben Ownby. Sean Hornbeck was abducted in 2002, so that charge may not apply to him. There is a kidnapping charge in Missouri that with a penalty of 5 to 15 years.
So it has a much less penalty as opposed to the child kidnapping law, which has a penalty of life.
Right, 10 to 30 years or life.
Right. Well, anything more known about how these young men might have been kidnapped? Again, it's alleged. Sean was reportedly riding his bike 4 years ago. Ben had just stepped off a bus. Anything more known about how they then made it to Devlin's apartment?
Well, I have been told that it was a forcible type of abduction. You know, I don't know if they were grabbed. I don't know if they were enticed into the vehicle, but they were prevented from leaving.
And have police yet interviewed the two boys? Because initially, in the first few days, we were told they were sort of leaving them alone.
I believe they have talked to some psychologists associated with law enforcement. I think they've had some brief interviews with law enforcement. I think they are trying to be respectful of the experience, and but we have so little information right now in terms of what they went through. I don't really know.
Is there anything more known about Michael Devlin? Did he have any previous criminal record? And did he know either of these boys, perhaps through the Internet?
We found nothing. I mean, he a couple of traffic tickets, a tax suit over some state taxes that they say he didn't file back, I think, in the 80s and 90s. There's been some speculation out there about he may have known the boys. But what I've been told is he did not know either one of these boys before allegedly abducted them.
Do we know anything more about the computer messages that have been found that were sent to, for instance, Sean's family's website? They'd set up a website looking for lost kids. They were signed Sean Devlin. Sean, in other instances, is known to have used Michael Devlin's last name as his own. But were they from Sean Hornbeck, or were they posted by Michael Devlin?
I don't think anyone knows that for sure right now. And I think it's so early that I think it'll be a long time before we know whether those are indeed Sean Hornbeck's.
What, if anything, are police saying about what happened in that house?
Well, law enforcement right now is being pretty quiet on this, obviously. They don't want to mess up any future prosecution. But I have been told that there were threats made against Sean Hornbeck and his family along the lines of, I will kill you and your family. That's what I've been told. Hmm. I was also told this morning that there might be some move to impose a gag order. So we may see a lot less of that information coming out.
Well, from what we understand, Sean's family is on their way to the Oprah Winfrey show, but apparently with the restriction that Sean will not say anything.
Right, and that has been the restriction for both boys.
Do we understand that the boys may not even have talked to their parents about it yet?
Yeah, I think both parents have said, you know, we're not going to push him on this. We're just happy to have him back.
Robert Patrick, court reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we turn now to Dr. Sharon Cooper, a developmental and forensic pediatrician and professor of pediatrics at the University of North Carolina. And Dr. Cooper, we don't want to in any way take the focus of blame off the alleged abductor, but people are trying to understand the behavior of Sean. And you well know that they're having a hard time understanding how a child with as much freedom to leave as he had didn't. Is that surprising to you?
No, it is not surprising to me, because this child was abducted at such a young age.
11.
Right. And remember that when you have a child who is so young and who is physically removed from any recognizable environment that he would call home or city or anything that would help him to know where he could find help, he then becomes completely dependent upon the offender who has abducted him.
Well, but still, I mean, Sean Hornbeck had access to a cell phone. He apparently, allegedly, used the Internet. He went out alone with friends. He drove a truck with a friend. He was even stopped late one night about 2 years ago by a policeman. He was Sean was riding his bike without reflectors, and the policeman stopped him, and he said his name was Sean Devlin. Devlin, of course, being the name of
the
his
offender.
Alleged abductor.
Right.
I mean, that is just so outside of people's understanding. I mean, we've seen kidnapped victims like Elizabeth Smart, who are watched all the time by her kidnappers. This was a young man who was really out by himself.
He was out by himself nearly 2 years after he had been abducted.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that he had this type of freedom for the first year or maybe even 2 years after he was abducted. And when you consider young children and how their perception of time, the passage of time is, after a while they accommodate to the environment that they're in. We also don't know exactly how he was intimidated by the offender, but it is reported that he was told that his family would have been harmed had he tried to escape. And such a message to a child then places the safety of his family upon his behavior. And therefore, it is not unusual for children to seek to protect their family members at all costs when they are in circumstances like this.
In other reporting, I once heard a specialist say that when an abductor makes that threat, they usually have a demonstration that goes along with it to demonstrate that they can, that they have the capability of killing the family. And in one case, an abductor killed a puppy in front of a child, which had to have been completely traumatizing.
That is correct. And there is no reason for us to think that Sean should have disbelieved this particular offender. He was deprived, we must remember, of all alternative messages. He wasn't allowed to go to school. He wasn't allowed to have contact with any extended family members. He wasn't allowed to participate, as far as we're aware of initially, with any normal social activities, yes, such as groups, Boy Scouts, etc. So he was deprived and isolated for a significant amount of time before the abductor began to allow him to have more freedom.
But he did have friends that he played with, friends that slept over at his house, the apartment that he lived in with the alleged abductor. And I'm just wondering, again, we in no way are placing blame on, as you said, a child. But, Doctor, is there even the chance, and are there cases of kids who, you know, somebody's offering them no school, maybe a lot of pizza? The alleged abductor ran a pizza parlor during the day. Is there a chance that there's a child that might be lured because a situation is set up that's more fun, more freeing than the one he had with his family?
No, I think it was a situation of no other alternatives, the child not perceiving other alternatives early on. Mm-hmm. When we hear about him having sleepovers and things of that nature, that appeared to occur when he was closer to 13 or 14 years of age. And remember, he was very young and had been with this person then almost exclusively for a pretty long period of time.
Yeah.
Most children would have finally accommodated to that particular new life and would have taken it on as the life that they had, the only life that they knew at that point.
And again, could think that his own family was dead. Dr. Sharon Cooper, a developmental and forensic pediatrician and professor of pediatrics at the University of North Carolina. She's going to come back after the break to give parents advice on how to talk to their children about the danger of kidnapping. And not just the little guys. Most of the kids who are kidnapped are teenagers. And don't forget, later in the program, an evangelical minister who is making a case for protecting the environment. Much more coming up here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Dr. Sharon Cooper, developmental and forensic pediatrician and professor of pediatrics at the University of North Carolina. And we're talking about the case of those two boys from Missouri who were allegedly kidnapped by the same man and then reunited with their families last week. One, Ben Ownby, who's 13, spent 4 days in captivity. But the other, Sean Hornbeck, was allegedly kidnapped more than 4 years ago when he was 11 and had been living with his alleged captor with freedom, such as playing with friends and riding a bike alone. And Dr. Cooper, all of this raises the question, do you and other experts believe that there may be other children out there who might be living with their abductors?
Well, I think that would be true. If we recall the case of Natasha Kampusch from Austria that occurred in August of last year, recall that she had been missing for 8 years, and she had been abducted and was really not very far from where her family lived. Mm-hmm. Another case where others saw her in the neighborhood and thought she was the daughter of her abductor. Let us hope that these children are alive. I know their family's hope is that they are alive as compared to having been murdered. When we think about Sean and Ben, both of them were very fortunate because they beat the odds. The average lifespan of a child who is a victim of a stranger abduction is only 3 hours after they are taken. 74% are killed within the first 3 hours.
There are other statistics we should remind ourselves of. There are far fewer non-family abductions, I think 58,000. Then family abductions, 203,000. So it's far more likely to be someone that the child knows.
Correct.
And as you said, 40% of children in abductions are killed. But what's jumped out at us, and I don't know how we hadn't seen this before, teenagers are by far, and these are federal statistics, teenagers are by far the most frequent victims of all kidnappings?
Correct. That is true. And that helps us to understand some of the issues of commercial sexual exploitation, what happens to children, for example, who run away from home and who are ultimately domestically trafficked from one part of our country to another part of our country. A very important population of missing children that we have not been able to really get a good handle on, and we're beginning to understand better now that we recognize internet crimes against children and sexual exploitation through prostitution of children and youths. The fact that we need to pay more attention to children who may be seen as runaways, who in fact have frequently been abducted and trafficked away from their homes.
And what would keep this child from returning home? I mean, of course, obviously, they may have someone who isn't allowing them physically to leave, but is it shame? Is it, you know, if it's an older child who certainly can understand, they can watch this news story about Sean and certainly can understand that they could go back, what would keep them from going home?
Very often, self-blame, shame, and a belief in the brainwashing, if you will, that has been provided to them since he was less than 12 years of age.
This would be Sean.
That either his family would be harmed or that his family wasn't even alive anymore.
Well, given this, and given the statistic that children who are abducted are sometimes older than we think, what should parents do? What should a parent say to a child?
I think that a parent should certainly make their children feel safe and not be worried to walk up and down the street. We don't want our children to live in terror all the time. However, I believe that parents should always reiterate to their children how much they care for them and how much they love them.
I mean, should it be the straightforward, if someone tells you that I am, you know, dead, or if someone tells you that I will be killed, don't believe them?
Yes, because most of the time, if a parent dies, the child is aware. They're there. They're at the funeral. So if the parent should tell their children, if someone tells you that I'm dead and you haven't seen proof for yourself, don't necessarily believe it. Try everything that you can to try to get back in touch with me or with anybody else in our family whom you know. And always recognize that if a stranger is the person who is telling you this information, always take that with a grain of salt, because I always love you. I think one of the things that's important to recognize is that when kids become teenagers and they're seeking to emancipate themselves from their families, which is a normal developmental process, many times they begin to resist and resent some of the restrictions that are placed for them, for their own safety, by their parents. So parents need to blend the rules and regulations with the message that I always love you, I always will love you, and everything that I'm doing is really to protect you. So if anything should ever happen, don't believe that I'm not here for you.
Dr. Cooper, we've talked quite a bit, and as a nation, we've had dialogue about what to tell little kids. And just to remind ourselves, you know, you can't tell a little kid, don't talk to a stranger. They don't know what a stranger is.
Right. That's correct. In fact, when I think today we are in a new era, because when we talk about safety messages to children, we have to speak about safety messages online and safety messages offline, because children dialogue with people that we as adults would refer to as strangers in both venues. And I think that when we talk about online safety, it's important for us to understand that offenders who seek to lure children and youths online are not strangers to them.
And if it's a 3 or a 4-year-old, someone's not a stranger if they come up to you and they're nice and they ask you to go look for a lost puppy.
this is correct. This is one of the reasons that when we're talking about offline safety from a parental perspective, we've changed in a lot of the ways that we handle even how we dress children. We tell parents not to give children clothing that has their name on it, because a person will walk up and speak to the child by their first name, which will make the child instantly believe that they're supposed to know that person.
Right. But back to the older kids. I mean, they're supposed to know this stuff, but I think it's a reminder that often a 17, 18, 16-year-old is just as vulnerable.
Oh, this is so very true. We now understand from the neuroarchitectural research of the brain that the adolescent brain is certainly not mature, particularly in the frontal lobe where we have the decisions and judgment, where those decisions are made. And so because of this, even though these children have adult-like bodies, it doesn't mean that they have adult-like minds. And it's very important for us to recognize how we need to still continue to give them a very important protection message, and that we are telling them these messages because we care for them and we don't want anything to happen to them.
Dr. Sharon Cooper, a developmental and forensic pediatrician and professor of pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, a quick note about tomorrow's program. Nursing is more popular than ever. People are lining up for schooling, so why is the nursing shortage getting worse? Also, music suitable for a cold winter's day from the Finnish group Vartina. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding for It's Here and Now. Today in Washington, D.C., leaders of the nation's evangelical movement and some of the nation's most prominent secular scientists gathered at the National Press Club in a landmark meeting to combat global warming and other environmental ills. The first of its kind collaboration is in part because of a challenge thrown down by Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson, who told us back in October of his effort to help secular scientists and church leaders overcome their differences over the origin of life and join together to save the Earth.
I feel we should stop wrangling over the unanswerable and recognize that the two most powerful forces in the world are religion and science, and that if they were combined in a common goal, there's very little that they could not accomplish.
Well, joining us now is Pastor Joel Hunter. He heads the Northland Church, a megachurch with 12,000 members in the Orlando, Florida area, and he is one of the signers of today's urgent call to action statement, and we want to find out more about that. But first, welcome, Pastor Hunter.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, nice to have you. And you'd already made somewhat of a name for yourself in this arena. Do I understand that you turned down the presidency of the Christian Coalition of America because you wanted to expand into areas such as global warming and the board didn't?
That's exactly the point. There are some Christians that are just pretty focused on a few very narrow issues, and that's, I understand that. But there are these huge issues that we need to address for the good of all mankind and for the furtherance of what Jesus cared about. And so I just needed to go on with some of these other issues.
Well, E.O. Wilson says in his book, The Creation, that the divide that you're talking about is because of the dispensationalists. These are evangelicals who take the book of Revelation literally, and they point to the rapture, the second coming of Christ, in which the earth is destroyed. And they say, well, you know, why spend time saving the planet? That's the plan, that it's to be destroyed. Is that part of the debate or dialogue that you are confronted with?
Well, not really.
Please tell us.
It's a part of it, but there are very few Christians that stick to such a theological path, mm-hmm, that they don't open up to other things. I mean, there are some who know who have a particular theology, and yes, they will always be narrow, and they'll always be uninterested in taking care of the earth because they think it's going to be destroyed anyhow. The larger group, though, that is a greater challenge are people who are just used to doing the same thing, and they're just kind of afraid of getting out of their own backyard and looking at some of these larger issues. And so if we can show the skeptics why issues like this are really a fulfillment of what we are to do in Scripture, and they express the compassion of Christ, and they honor God by taking care of his creation, I think that most Christians will just be ready to go on this thing.
Well, you know,
they need to explain.
It's funny. E.O. Wilson says that. He says that, in fact, that is a part of the job of people on the left wing of the environmental movement as well, because there are many people who feel shut out of it because it's sort of positioned as a liberal issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's absolutely right. And by the way, I love this guy. He's a wonderful man. I'm just so glad to be his colleague. But yeah, it's continuing to educate and mobilize that 85% in the middle that really do want to do the right thing, but they just need the tools to do it.
Well, now representatives of the secular science community and evangelicals have met. They originally met for 3 days last fall at a retreat in Georgia. And today you released this urgent call to action statement, 28 evangelical and scientific leaders. It was sent to President Bush, to the White House, to congressional leaders. What do you want to see happen?
Well, there's lots. It's a multifaceted approach. There is a political aspect to it. We do want to influence public policy. We're meeting this afternoon with many Senator Boxer, representatives from Lugar. Senator Obama has backed the statement with a statement. Tomorrow it's Senator McCain. So there are many people who are interested in hearing more and devising legislation that will address this problem. Further, though, and this is very important, we need to engage business. We need to engage the marketplace. This needs to have a market-based solution, not just a government. Legislation alone can't really handle it, and it has to also have a broad-based participation by the 2 billion Christians in the world that want to start being responsible for the creation.
So you're talking about people maybe doing things within their church, but maybe there also being laws requiring. Well, I'm wondering, mandatory caps on greenhouse gas emissions. Would you want that too?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it has to be a multifaceted. I think, you know, every pastor can give his or her congregation 10 things that they can do personally, starting with replacing incandescent bulbs with compact fluorescents.
Well, funny, we're going to speak about that in a moment, but keep going.
Well, terrific. Okay. And then next, you can decide what you can do as a church for your, you know, for your community, how you can retrofit your church to be energy efficient. And then you also can engage the business community in not only coming up with solutions, but buying products that are environmentally responsible.
But sir, then, I'm sorry, I was going to ask, what do you do, though, about the White House in the couple minutes we have? Because President Bush has said he will outline a policy on global warming in the State of the Union address, and there was a rumor flying around that he was going to drop his opposition to mandatory limits on greenhouse gas emissions. But Tony Snow, his spokesperson, has said, absolutely not, that's wrong, we're going to hold on to our beliefs.
Well, all we can do is continue to be a voice to anybody that's in power, including the White House, to say this is a very urgent matter for all mankind, and especially those in the United States. And we have a responsibility, being the nation we are, to take the leadership in this. And we will say it as strongly as we can, and then kind of let the chips fall where they may. But we will continue to bring this to those in power in our government.
Well, we began by saying that you think it's the job of everyone involved to help evangelicals in particular see their way on this. I mean, you are their pastor. Is there a passage from the Bible that you think helps do that, about stewardship?
Sure. Yeah. Genesis 2:15. It's very direct. He told it to Adam, and of course, Adam, the root word of Adam is all man, and he gave him an order for the garden. To take care of the land that he was given. He said, cultivate it and keep it. And the Hebrews really literally mean the same thing you see on police cars all the time, serve and protect. So it's a direct order from God that we should cultivate and protect the earth we've been given.
Whether or not you believe it was created 2,000 years ago or millions of years ago.
That's right, exactly.
Well, Joel Hunter, senior pastor of Northland Church in the Orlando, Florida area. thousands of members of his church and one of the signers of the urgent call to action, a statement from evangelical and secular scientists delivered today to the White House and congressional leaders. Pastor Hunter, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I was glad to do it.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, the pastor mentioned urging his flock to use more compact fluorescent light bulbs, and the giant Walmart is trying to do the same thing. They recently announced they're joining the movement to sell more compact fluorescent light bulbs. Fluorescents last longer and use less energy than traditional incandescent bulbs, but fluorescent bulbs can be a hard sell. They cost more. People think they're noisy. Some people think they're dangerous. And fluorescent light is, well, unflattering. Well, Keith Yancey, though, has been won over. He's principal light designer with Lamb Partners in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He joins us now. And Keith, isn't that right that people have this perception that they just don't look good under fluorescent light?
Well, that's true, and that comes from years of fluorescent technology, I guess. But with today's technology, it's a lot better than it used to be.
Well, let's talk about the technology. How do the two different kinds of bulbs work? How does incandescent work and how does fluorescent work?
Well, an incandescent source is basically a small wire, the filament, that glows. So the idea of incandescence is that it's what they refer to a lot as a full-spectrum source.
Right, so you plug it in and it lights up the wire, which lights up the bulb, and it's sort of a warm light.
That's right. Fluorescence is a little different because it uses an arc. Basically, it strikes an arc between two cathodes. That arc excites these phosphors, the white powder that you see on a fluorescent tube, and turns that into visible light.
How do they compare? I mean, as fluorescent light is improved, is it as warm looking as incandescent light?
It is, and there's a lot of times when it's very difficult to tell the difference.
Huh.
One of the other things that we rate fluorescent lighting on is something that's called color rendering. How accurate do colors look under a fluorescent source? You know, when you go to a store sometime and you buy a pair of brown pants or something, they look different when you bring them home,
right,
because you're looking at them under incandescent sources versus fluorescent that you might have bought them at the store. But that color rendering property is getting a lot better than it used to be in the past.
We know you've designed well-known spaces like the Guggenheim Museum in Spain, the new Boston Convention Center.
Right.
What's a cost comparison? Because that seems to be also where people, you know, it's asking them to make a leap of faith, because how much is a fluorescent bulb compared to an incandescent?
These compact fluorescent sources used to be about 10 times the cost as a standard incandescent lamp or standard bulb. Now we're seeing a lot of these lamps with rebates and selling them at the stores for a lot less. So, for instance, when these things used to cost about 10 times as much as an incandescent source, now they're maybe only twice as much or so.
Let's say you spend $2 to $4 and you get a fluorescent light bulb, just a light bulb for a lamp. How long might that last?
A lot of those compact fluorescent sources have about a 10,000-hour life to them. So if they're on 8 hours a day or so, they may be 7 days a week. It could last up to 3 or 4 years.
We've been in rooms when you flick one on, you take the switch and flick it on, and it takes a second to get its full glow.
Yeah, that's right.
What is that?
That's one of the problems, too, that people sort of assign to fluorescent. It used to be a lot worse. You remember the old ones where they used to flicker and then finally come on.
Right.
Now they're sort of a program start. So it does take about a half a second or what seems an eternity sometime when you flip the switch and there's a slight delay in the lamp coming on. I think one of the other drawbacks, too, is that the fluorescents, the compact fluorescent sources, need a little bit of warm-up time. So when they come on, they're not at full brightness.
Just before we let you go, again, Keith Yancey, light designer with Lamb Partners in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We've said you do big projects. When you do a smaller project, do you try to push the consumer to get the fluorescent if their first reaction is, I can't, that's impossible, how can you even suggest that?
Usually the bottom line is how much do you want to pay on your energy bill, and if you convince people to spend a dollar more today to save $30 over the next few years. It's a tough sell sometimes, even with commercial clients. It's hard to sell them on anything but initial cost, but it's usually better for their pocketbook and ultimately better for the environment.
Keith, thanks so much.
Robin, thank you.
And one more quick note on fluorescent light bulbs. While they do save energy, remember we said some people think they're dangerous. Well, they can pose a danger to the environment if not properly disposed of. Fluorescents contain small amounts of mercury, and the Washington Post reports that one broken light bulb could contaminate as much as 7,000 gallons of water if it seeps into the groundwater. So fluorescents should be recycled separately, and you can contact your local government to find out more about that program in your area. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Young, it's here and now. This week, Russia's legendary Kirov Ballet takes the stage at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., performing their Soviet-era version of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet to Sergei Prokofiev's monumental score. The Kirov is known worldwide as the keeper of classical ballet's flame. But how do you take more than 200 years of ballet history on the road? During a previous tour, the Kirov rolled into Boston to perform Firebird, as well as other works. Here now's Lynn Menegon went backstage to meet the mixed Russian and American crew and found the magic that you see on stage starts in the dressing room.
Semen's chorus is going to be in this room right here for sure.
They're looking for how many rooms there are, how many people will fit in them.
Something for women. Probably split them up.
My name is Karen Clem, and my title is wardrobe supervisor. And then they'll decide which principals have their own rooms, who shares. They have the principals, the soloists, and then the corps de ballet.
So this gets into company politics?
Yes, definitely.
So this is a very tricky issue?
Yes.
Now, has there ever been a situation, I guess you could say the myth or the legend of the Russian prima ballerina, very tempestuous, temperamental perhaps?
Not that I have noticed. Everybody that I've met has been really wonderful.
So no one's saying, these roses are not red enough, or I want my champagne?
No, not at all.
Well, that's disappointing.
The rooms are not warm enough is mostly what I heard.
Take it upstage, please, on that pile.
I've been told we're traveling somewhere around 220 people.
Does that include dancers?
Yeah. My name is Pat Thomas. I'm the production stage manager for the Kirov. We've got two masseuses. We have a whole bunch of ballet masters. Often these soloists and principals have their own teacher. They have pianists, everything. The carpenters are grabbing their things. The prop guys are grabbing their things. So they're now plugging things in and making sure that everything turns on because it's a whole bunch of cable and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. Firebird is fairly straightforward. Chopiniana is very straightforward. It's just a backdrop. Firebird, there's the tree.
And, you know, looking at it on the floor here, it looks pretty unremarkable. I bet on stage it looks grand. It's just a bunch of chicken wire and some, like, paper leaves and some gold framing, gold-painted framing.
And then we add the good stuff. And it'll just be beautiful. You won't be able to even know it was the same thing. Yo.
So your production office is the first room?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to tell Grachev and
see
what
he decides. Yeah, and then on top of that, we can set up quick change booths, so they don't have to worry that these will have to... Yeah, Karen says there's like 10 guys in Firebird.
You're right.
So
You're right.
What's a quick change booth, and what does it solve?
At some point in Firebird, there's all these guys on stage running all over the place, and then within the space of about 2 minutes, they all have to get changed.
Actually, 2 minutes is a long time for a quick change. They get out of costumes, and they get into, I call it Fantasia dresses. They're a two-tiered, look like a dress over pants. We have six people there. We strip them out of it. Put the other one on, button it up, and off they go.
It's about
steam costumes, please begin with the white ones.
Okay.
With these ones.
I think we all speak theater, and that's what I've been asked before, do you really understand Russian? And I said no, but I speak wardrobe. And so in that, it's a universal language.
How do you pack a tutu?
If you'll see, they come out, they turn them inside out and fold them in half and stack them in the box.
So you can actually fold a tutu in half?
Well, this is the only time I've seen it folded is I worked two tours with the Bolshoi, and this is my first one with the Kirov, and they're the only ones that I've seen just fold them in half like that. I call them tutu tacos.
What happens with toe shoes?
They take care of the toe shoes themselves. They each have a bag of shoes.
The dancers take care of their own?
They take care of their own shoes.
And why is that?
They prep them themselves. Some of them take a hammer and break down the wooden box that's inside. Some of them wet them. They do whatever it takes to get them comfortable for them. And it would be impossible for somebody else to do it.
What's the worst wardrobe accident that has happened on this tour so far?
I think the worst thing that happened is with the extras. We have costumes that are built for dancers, and I had six pretty big guys to try to fit, so I had to put patches in the back, just strips of fabric about 6 to 10 inches wide to make the costumes fit.
Squeeze those guys into them.
You got to squeeze them in. The show must go on.
Charlie, upstage that leg now.
Okay.
Я не про это. Я
the one that's hanging.
Я про зеленые кулисы, про зеленые.
Okay. Today is all about steaming, a little bit of ironing. They're going to bring us racks. We're going to steam them up and prep them like any other show.
All right.
Do we have steamers available?
No. You have to have your own steamer.
There was supposed to be a rider sent ahead that said we needed six steamers.
No, we didn't get it.
Okay. This is something I need to take care of. Let me go find out about. Let me talk upstairs about the steamers and see if something was worked out.
Is this a real problem?
Yes, it is. That means about six more hours of work.
All right, let's see what happens.
The ballet bars, the white ones.
Yeah, we're going to store them somewhere up here.
We're not going to get the same truck back, right?
Right, because they're going to containers.
Okay.
I'm the road prop man. My name's Joe Giordano.
Things must go wrong sometimes, or do they more often go right?
More often right. The artistic director will come on stage after every piece and instruct them the things they've done right or done wrong, and that's every night, every piece, where American companies, you don't see that as much.
That's why it works so well.
Mm-hmm. And everything is so precise with them.
OTs, 6 meters.
This one. Stage right.
How are things going?
Better now.
You got your steamers?
I've got my steamers.
Sounds good. So everything's on track? You got
everything's on track.
And there are a lot of wrinkly costumes hanging around.
Yes, there are.
All of a sudden, the Firebird tree has been transformed from a chicken wire and green paper leaves to golden apples and leaves, and it's pretty magical looking.
For 6 weeks now, wherever we've been, I've turned around and things happen to bloom. It's come out, it's magic, it just shows up.
All of a sudden you're in the magical kingdom of the Firebird.
Exactly.
It's okay.
Я не про это, я
the one that's hanging.
Я про зеленые кулисы, про зеленые.
Here it's leveled with a black leg.
Yeah.
And over there, it's gone.
Here and now's Lynn Menegon, backstage with the crew of the Kirov Ballet on a previous tour. They're currently in Washington, D.C. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.